Today I come in front of you as a PhD student. I'm presenting my research. This is the second year data research that I'll be presenting under the detection and characterization of Salmonella species and the correlation with the microbial indicators of North Carolina tomato production environments. Talk to you a little bit about tomatoes in general. We're looking at a U.S. farm market value of over $1 billion. With the nutritional values that we're seeing, all of the improved varieties, and the health-linked benefits such as prostate cancer and heart disease. And then looking at the national outbreaks that are associated with those contaminated tomatoes. I'll share with you a little bit more about that on those outbreaks. And looking at what's causing these outbreaks and the exact sources within the growing systems are not clearly designated for us at this time. Looking at the associated outbreaks over the last from 1990 to 2009, remembering we're looking at a fresh produce commodity, so that there is no still kill step in that. During this time period, we had a number of 42 outbreaks with tomatoes. And they were specifically the large red round tomatoes, the commodities that are grown commercially. And Salmonella accounted for 79% of those outbreaks, with E. coli accounting for 2%. What really kind of kicked us into high gear was the prolonged multi-state recurrent outbreaks that were associated with Salmonella Newport on tomatoes on the eastern coast of Virginia. And as you've heard from other talks earlier this morning or this afternoon, generic E. coli has been claimed as an indicator species for fecal contamination. Under FSMA, which is the Food Safety Modernization Act, under specifically the produce rule, they're looking at a correlation between generic E. coli and fecal contamination that is very strong, but it doesn't always reliably predict the presence of other pathogens. And so when we start looking at the linkage from outbreaks and 79% of Salmonella being responsible for those outbreaks, and then some of the previous data that has been found with research looking at the different Salmonella species, the serotypes that have been identified in that research with other commodities, they're seeing or maybe proposing that there might be some competitive advantage between the species. So we wanted to look at some of that correlation between this indicator species, generic E. coli, and the Salmonella that we'll be studying here for tomatoes. Additional pieces that are important to understand is that because large numbers were affected in these outbreaks, they're looking at contamination, suspecting that it's happening early on in the production system. So in the fields and in pack houses where they can accumulate to large numbers. They're looking at quite a few possible sources, including water, manure, workers, and workers handling it when they're sick. And the scientific data that's out there is limited, linking those sources and the transfer, so knowing where this is happening and how it gets transferred, and then where the fate of that pathogen is within that production system. We also know that using generic E. coli as an indicator species for Salmonella might be problematic, in that Salmonella has been found to withstand a greater ranges of environmental stresses. And so it might not be the best indicator for this. So some of the questions that we had going into this three-year study was, are there specific endemic environmental niches that Salmonella and E. coli have in the environment, and where are they entering that environment? Are there native microbial populations that affect tomato and this human pathogen contamination? And then what is that correlation between Salmonella species and the generic E. coli as that indicator species? So the objectives then become for this project were to identify those environmental niches for Salmonella, to characterize the isolates or the serotypes to know if they are of public health significance, and then to correlate whether Salmonella and generic E. coli can be correlated and be a good true indicator species. We used three farms of 60 to 70 plants. It was an observational block. These were using commercial production standards and spray programs, which looked at fumigated lands, plastic culture with drip lines, and using commercial tomato varieties, which were the red round slicers. Salmonella was monthly sampled for the 2 years during the summer seasons. We also took temperature and time of day, so we have that data. And then the E. coli was correlated with water samples taken again during those monthly times where we were collecting Salmonella. So this is an overview of all the samples that were taken. If you look, the production fields on the sample type, that included soil, native vegetation, any feces, specifically goose feces where it was present, tomatoes, tomato blossoms, and tomato leaves. Water sources included the ponds, streams, distribution water through the irrigation, and sediment. So this is showing you what we did with those samples when we came in and processed them. On your left is using the FDA BAM method, which is the Bacterial Analytical Methods method, which is the gold method for food analysis, which we modify because we're dealing with environmental samples. In the middle, we're looking at a proof of concept molecular, looking at PCR to give us a pre-screening to allow us to plug that into the plating that we did. Once we had the isolates, we put them through the Bioplex for molecular serotyping, the Vitex for biochemical, and PFGEs for the DNA fingerprinting. And then pulling all of that together, we looked at generic E. coli on the far right hand of your screen using the IDEX Coal Alert. We did a quantitative assessment of that, put all that together, and this is what we came up with. We looked at the frequency of Salmonella recovered during these 2 years out of 1,010 samples. Essentially, look at the bottom column on this. If you look from your far right, you've got sample type and then total number of positive samples. You see that there were 33 positive samples obtained from that 1,010 samples taken. From that, we had 115 isolates. And so if you look at the relative frequency, it's 3.3% of Salmonella positives found in those 110 samples. What was of particular interest was that the water and sediment made up 30 positive samples of the 33, and it made 106 isolates of the 115. So really looking at the water and the sediment were our main focus because that was accounted for 92% of the samples positives that we found. So in looking at those isolates on this data slide, you're looking again down the right-hand column. You've got the predicted serotypes that were found, and then moving across the slide to your left breaks out the places where these sample positives were found, including sediment, surface waters, which were stream and pond, and then the field irrigation waters, which was the distribution systems. So we found that all of the PFGs that are predicted are of clinical significance because we measured this against PulseNet, which is a national surveillance system network that looks at clinically significant foodborne outbreaks. And so all of those identify serotypes or tied into that pulse net. There are, on the bottom there, you see no serotype predicted. Those are ones that just could not be predicted through pulse net, which means that they have not been tied to a foodborne outbreak as of yet. So you'll see the most diversity in the stream sediment with the serotypes that are in there. And then you see the highest number of serotypes in the stream surface waters. Then looking at the correlation between generic E. coli and Salmonella, this slide is very simple in that it looks at presence and absence of Salmonella on your top and generic E. coli on your bottom. I broke out the generic E. coli in that it was present if it was greater than 235 mpn per 100 milliliters, and then absent if it was less than that, because that's the guideline we have from FSMA, the produce rule currently. So if you look across the two slides, the green ones are showing 81% that generic E. coli was accurately predicting the presence of Salmonella. What's of concern is where you see the 17%, which is in the kind of beige-colored block there, where we see generic E. coli over-predicting the presence of Salmonella, and then the 2%, which is showing that generic E. coli was not able to predict Salmonella. And that's a big issue right there, because we're looking at a public health significance. So that 2% correlates to one sample, and that one sample could actually get into our system and cause illness. So the conclusions I have is that we recovered 3% of Salmonella from all of our samples, and it is important to note currently we do not have any outbreaks associated with North Carolina production with Salmonella, even though I did find 3%. The major niches that we identified was the water source and sediment at 92%, and that did remain constant across the production seasons during both years. It also drilled down just a little bit more in that we had a dynamic water source, which was the streams and the stream sediments, accounting for 78% of those positive isolates. 69 isolates were identified as the potential clinical significance during PulseNet, and 37 of them could not be predicted. So they're still out there. They might cause illness, but we're not sure. Don't have that data to support that. The diversity of those serotypes was greatest in the stream. And then, again, what I mentioned for the correlation for the microbial indicator was that we were able to identify it 81%, but ideally from a public health standpoint, we want it at that 100%. Thanks to my graduate advisors committee, and if I have time, I'll take questions. 2 minutes. I think a lot of them are testing their water to understand, first of all, what hazards they have in the field. A lot of them are trying to follow the good agricultural practices, which would be the testing of the water. I know there's research going on for remediation of waters. When we're looking at stream surface waters, that becomes an unknown, because you don't know what's going on with those surface waters, who's upstream, what kind of wildlife is entering. And then, like I mentioned, they are using plastic culture, which is drip line, so it's not direct contact with the fruit. I think they could do a better job on their pesticide waters, but there again, it's that knowledge of that this is a concern now.
Do they have an action plan to deal with the outbreak?
We've worked with them on crisis management as a whole for the industry. I think they still need to come to that table. Kurt.
Quick opinion type question. So your work and others, and I hear it too in Arizona and California, that generic E. coli evaluation may not be a good method. Mm-hmm. So what is the good method? Right? So we have a method, 81% of the time it's going to be a good method, but what's the answer, is it, in your opinion?
So the question is, what, in my opinion, is the best method for identifying pathogens in the field if generic E. coli is only catching 81%? And I think we probably need to be looking at a panel. I don't think one indicator species is going to work for this because we're dealing with environments. They're highly variable, and you're dealing with different commodities that have different, you know, we all do different research, and each one reacts differently. Thank you.